This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, one of the iconic spaghetti westerns of the 1960s, has just been released in a special DVD edition. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear an interview with Eli Wallach, one of the stars of that landmark 1966 film. He played Tuco, the ugly referred to in the title. But first, we have an interview Terry conducted with Clint Eastwood and Eastwood's biographer, Time film critic Richard Schickel. Schickel also provides the audio commentary for the new DVD release. Clint Eastwood became a TV star as Rowdy Yates on Rawhide, but left that series in midstream to go overseas and make movies with Italian film director Sergio Leone. Eastwood's stoic and vengeful character, who appeared in several films, was dubbed the Man with No Name, but it made Eastwood not just a star, but an icon. When Terry spoke with Eastwood in 1997, she spoke fondly about the series Rawhide, but didn't expect Eastwood to do the same.
Actually, I liked the role. It was we just used to sit around the set and use self-demeaning kind of humor as a way of keeping our sanity out there doing a series week in, week out. And I think that Eric Fleming used to call himself Mr. Failure instead of Mr. Favor, and I used to call myself Rodney Yates Trail Flunky. And we just kind of... just joke about it. It was nothing that nobody disliked the series particularly. We just had, it was just kind of a way, and somebody picked up on it, I guess, is that it was a total unhappiness. It wasn't unhappiness. It was just kind of a way that, to keep yourself amused, I suppose. Eventually, when you do a series, after the years go by, you do start to get frustrated. You'd like to go on and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I'm no exception in that case.
Did you have any sense that your future was going to be in Westerns and in action films? Did you have a sense of that for yourself?
No, a lot of people thought, well, he's a tall guy. Maybe he'd be good in Westerns. For some reason, somebody thinks that Western heroes are tall guys for some reason. That sort of based upon the predecessors of Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Randolph Scott, and what have you over the years. So they thought, well, maybe he'll play in Westerns or what have you. But nobody really knew. No, I was just kind of out there and hanging about, studying acting, and it was a steady job. It was kind of nice at the time.
Well, in some of your action roles, in some of your Westerns and, Dirty Harry films, you not only don't say a lot, but what you do say, you're saying often through clenched teeth, in that really guttural voice. How did you develop that style of speaking?
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I think that the character just drives you in that. It's a character who is maybe frustrated with the things that the common person on the street are frustrated with, the bureaucracy that we live in, the nightmare that we as a civilization have placed on ourselves. I think this is a person who is frustrated with that, especially if you're trying to solve a case in a limited amount of time. So make my day line, or the do you feel lucky punk kind of lines, were lines that people gravitated towards.
Did you have a sense of that reading the script that, presidents would be, improvising on those lines, and that they would just enter the general vocabulary? Could you read a script and say, these lines are going to last beyond the film?
Nobody can say that for sure, but you can kind of find the lines that are sort of squelch lines, the ones that come in and put a topper on it. I think the appeal of some of those early characters was the fact that the man would have the right answer, and it was always usually very terse and kind of right to the point, but with a little bit of humor involved. So that everybody said, God, I would love to be able to do that.
Have you ever been able to do that, have just the right comeback at just the right moment?
Very rarely.
Right. Now, when you're doing a line like Make My Day, and you know, okay, this is a really good line, do you, like, go home and do line readings and go, make my day, make my day, make my day, and just do it over and over until you figure out exactly how you want to do it?
Looking into the bathroom right. mirror and doing some of your best acting.
Are you talking to me?
No, I don't. I don't go over the lines. I don't play them out loud. I'd rather play them for the first time when I do them.
No,
and
really?
I usually do them by the motivation of what the feelings are at the time. So I start them from what the intent is, and then let it kind of go out. It's sort of like a blowing through a trumpet or something. You start, and the sound magnifies as it comes out. If you sit there and practice line readings to yourself, you'll just get confused.
I want to get to your spaghetti westerns, the films you made with Sergio Leone. You started the Sergio Leone films when you were still making Rawhide, the TV western. How did Sergio Leone get to see Rawhide and decide you were the one to star in his western?
He had seen an episode that somebody was showing around, an agency had in Rome. And he had seen an episode, and they thought, well, here's a chance to hire an American actor who has been doing westerns, but is not very expensive. And that, they didn't have any.
Right.
They didn't have any money to spend, so they didn't have a lot of choices as far as names of the moment.
There's a lot of really interesting facial close-ups in your movies with Sergio Leone, and he had a very iconographic way of shooting faces, particularly your face. And your face in those close-ups is often, mysterious, unknowable. Instead of the facial close-ups like revealing this essence of who you are, they reveal the unknowability of who you are. And I've always wondered, what were you thinking during those close-ups to get the right expression on your face?
The first response would be to say absolutely nothing. To get the George Cukor used to say, he'd tell Greta Garbo sometimes to look into the camera and stare and don't think about a thing. But that's maybe a little oversimplification or a way to get a certain effect out of her at that time. But you think about what you're doing with the plot line, what the demands are of the plot. Usually, because this character, though he wasn't saying a lot, he was plotting a lot, and so you just thought about what your next moves were. It's just a question of thinking like you would in regular in real life. And you may be thinking, you have an inner monologue. Every actor plays an inner monologue as you're playing your outer character. And sometimes your outer character is saying, good evening, it's wonderful to see you. But underneath you might be saying, yeah, dirty, rotten. So, you know, you really don't care. And so that's your inner monologue. And so I might have been saying something like that to myself at the time is, you know,
you
I don't like these guys. I'd like to, you know, blow them all away, but I'd be very pleasant at the moment.
You developed a squint also in some of those close-ups.
Well, that was just the sunlight.
Yeah.
They bomb me with a bunch of lights, and you're outside, and it's 90 degrees. It's hard not to squint.
Richard Schickel, I want to ask you what you think of the importance of the Sergio Leone films in Clint Eastwood's filmmaking career.
Oh, I sort of think that Clint would have made his way into wider public consciousness in some other fashion. But I do also feel that those movies were so singular. They were truly, deeply, profoundly revisionist Westerns, as Clint has often said, at a time when the Western was in a kind of a dull place. The traditions of the Western in America had been kind of used up, and though we were in a period where Westerns were very popular in television and coming out of a period in which they had been very popular in the theaters, nonetheless, you know, the basic Western moves, the traditional moves, had become dull and overused and kind of cliche-ridden. And I think it's one of the things that drew Clint to this was that opportunity, not just for his own character to expand a bit, but for him to participate in a kind of a revision of a form that he actually liked. I mean, it's important to remember that, Clint does know quite a bit about film history and so forth. He had seen Yojimbo, the Kurosawa movie, which was a source for this particular movie, for Fistful of Dollars, and he'd seen it 2 years before and had said, hey, this would make a great Western, but I don't think anybody in America will make it because it's too tough. And here were these crazy Italians who were, you know, willing to do exactly that.
Clint Eastwood, since there's been these great iconographic close-ups of your face, I'm wondering what you think of your face as a man, an actor, and as a director, because you've had to work with your face as a director and look at it very objectively, I'd imagine.
As a director, you think of yourself as another character. A lot of times when I'm talking to the editor, I'll say, when he comes in the room and she does this and hey, that goes here and what have you, I never think of myself in the first person. It's just you have to do that, and you know you don't dwell on your face. You dwell on the fact that you're there and the character. And if you think too much about certain things, you can get yourself very confused. So, rather than do that, you just forge right on ahead with what you're doing.
Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel speaking to Terry Gross. We'll be back with more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to more of Terry's interview with Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel.
Now, in Richard Schickel's book about you, he says that, Rawhide followed the strict production code of the time. You couldn't show a fired gun and the victim of the bullet in the same shot. There had to be an edit in between. What was your reaction to Sergio Leone's really vivid approach to violence?
Well, that was true. The Hays office at that time had a rule for Westerns only, ironically, and you couldn't show the shootee and the shooter in the same shot. It couldn't be a tie-up shot, in other words. So you'd have to do it as an individual cut. And if you look at even later American Westerns of High Noon, you won't see the tie-up. But Sergio didn't know about all that, and I wasn't about to tell him because I was really enjoying this. It was breaking all, we were trying to break all the molds. And in breaking all the molds, it made those pictures a hit, or as somewhat of a revisionist idea, or certainly an outsider's point of view. They became popular, but they also brought with it some resentment, as you and Richard touched on earlier in the show. There was a lot of people who felt that who was this upstart? We didn't come in and bless this guy to come along, and we didn't bless these movies to come along, an Italian interpretation of the great American genre. So there was a certain resentment that hung around with those pictures for some time. Now, as people look back on them, they enjoy the fact that there was a different it was a different period, and then it went on to somebody else. And Sam Peckinpah came along later, and he did another look at the Western. And someone else comes along and does another one. And I come back to him and take another shot. And somebody else down the line. That way it keeps the great American art form alive.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting when you do look back at the Leone films is today, despite all of the hubbub about their violence, they're not terribly violent movies by modern standards. You know,
there's a lot of really sick, sadistic people in them.
That's true, and yet Leone, for the most part, does not linger on the actual violence. He lingers on the lead-up to violence.
I mean, the savoring kind of the violence.
There's a kind of a dance, and almost, sort of stately minuet leading up to the violence. I mean, the concluding shootouts and these things, it's a long and elegant time as people circle one another and in effect threaten one another. But the actual death is very quick. It's very clean. You know, we don't see a lot of blood squibs going off in the Peckinpah manner, or slow motion death. Death is, in these movies, as it so often is in life. I mean, it's quick, nasty, brutal, but it's not something that is in and of itself aestheticized. What's around it is aestheticized, but that the actual moment is not. It's shown for the brutal thing that it is.
Clint Eastwood, I thought that your choice of directing and starring in The Unforgiven was such an interesting choice, because it's a movie about a man who goes from bad man to good man to myth. And it's also interesting because it's about the difficulty of killing someone and what it takes out of you when you do kill someone. And you'd been in so many mythic movies and been in so many movies where the character that you played killed a lot of people. So I'm interested in how you related to the story in The Unforgiven and how it dealt with myth-making and with violence.
Well, those exact things that you mentioned are what attracted me to the project. The fact that, but even though I had done pictures where I've been a police officer and Western films where I've had a lot of gunplay and stuff, it's not that I approve of that sort of thing. And I don't necessarily approve of the romanticizing of gunplay, and I don't think it's... And I thought here was a chance, here was a story that had... that sort of shot holes in that, if you'll pardon the pun. You know, it brought out the truth about gunplay and the fact that there is some loss to your soul when you commit an act of violence. And to play a person who was deeply affected in his life because of some of the mayhem that he'd been responsible for was to me, made the character more interesting. It was more interesting for me to play. In fact, I never thought the film would be really commercial when I was making it, because it had all these statements about mayhem and violence, and I thought maybe this might not be a straight-ahead action movie that people wanted, but I liked the story and I felt it was worth telling.
Well, Clint Eastwood, I feel like I must talk with you a little bit about music, and to kick off this chapter of our interview, let's listen to this.
Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose. Let me saddle my old saddle underneath the west.
Terry, you should have seen the pain in this room, right?
And that's from the album Clint Eastwood Sings Cowboy Favorites. And there's a picture of Clint Eastwood as Rowdy Yates on the cover. Rawhide's Clint Eastwood Sings
that was,
Cowboy Favorites.
Yeah. I was the Millie Vanilli of the moment there. I did, that wasn't me.
Oh, yes, it was. I actually like your singing voice. I really do. I mean, this is a strange album with strange arrangements and not always good songs, but I really like your singing, and I imagine you're also like influenced by Chet Baker in your singing. And...
Well, that wasn't first place. That wasn't the kind of songs that I would normally like to sing.
The songs on here, I'd imagine not. But you got to sing Cole Porter. Don't fence me in.
There's nothing wrong with that. Cole Porter is certainly wonderful. But what happened is that somebody had the brilliant idea that that I should do some cowboy songs, not country western songs. Nashville type, but real straight cowboy songs, and I wasn't sure whether I liked the idea, but they said, "Well, we'll do it, and we have a session tomorrow." And I said, "Well, tomorrow I'm leaving." "Well, will you do it? You just stop by the studio on the way to the airport." So I did a whole album. You think about people who take 6 months to make an album, but this one, that we did the whole album in one session, and I didn't know the songs. I had to come in and learn them real quick. And some of them I knew, some songs like that you've heard as a child, but you don't really know them. And so it was a little frustrating. It wasn't my favorite musical experience in life, but it was, there again, you learn something every day.
Now, had you sung much before? Did you think of yourself as a singer at all?
Not really. I'd done a few things. I'd done a few records. I'd been involved in music, so I could sometimes carry a tune. My father loved singing. He had a group that played, and he loved to sing all the time. He would love to have been a singer more than anything, I think.
Now, I know you're still, and were as a young man, very passionate about jazz. Did you ever think that you'd become a professional musician instead of an actor and director?
Well, I thought about that earlier when I was a kid and I was doing some things, but I never thought, I never really knew what I wanted to do until I became an actor. And then at that point, I kind of knew which direction I was going to at least get up and swing at bat.
Would you like to sing more or play more? Or?
No, I don't have any there's a one of my key sayings.
Yes.
A man must know his limitations.
Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, speaking to Terry Gross in 1997. One of the films that made Eastwood a star, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, has just been released as a special edition DVD. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.